Good afternoon, everyone. Let's get started. Getting to the end game for this lengthy use of the English past tense as a way of exploring what it means to build a cognitive model and what the kind of scientific discourse that arises when competing theories start to try to get to grips with the details of the data about human performance, human mental behavior in a particular area. At the end of the lecture last time, we were starting to, we were once again looking at the role of the statistics in making detailed predictions. Now, as we looked at the training issues and at the time course, as we moved from trying to think about models of the, if you will, static adult competence in the past tense area, to demanding of the model that it actually give a story about the famous U-shaped curve, the actual behavior over time of the child learning the English past tense. And to pick up from there and start to elaborate it a bit, just a reminder that if we look across all different forms of the most commonly for the different verbs which occur in the Brown corpus, by which I mean that we're not just counting the token be, but all of the different forms of the verb to be, we get the top 10 exhibiting, first of all, classic Zipf's law, right? Be is more than twice as common as have, which is more than twice as common as do, which is nearly twice as common as say, and then it starts to flatten out, but still drops fairly dramatically. So within the top 10, we go from 40,000 to less than 1,500. And all of them are irregular. And the top four even have these irregular present tenses. If we look at the least commonly occurring verbs in the Brown corpus, there are hundreds of them, which only occur once. That's the least you can occur and still be in the corpus. And these are in alphabetical order because there are a lot of them. But there they are. I think none of them actually are the negative A prefix that some of you wrote about when you wrote about English. They're all regular, every one of them. And of all 877 single occurring verbs, verbs that occur exactly once in the million words of the Brown corpus, take a moment to guess what the number is going to be that I'm going to put up. How many of them do you think are going to be regular? Not all of them, but 860 of them. But in fact, we can get another 16 are actually irregulars that are prefixed, and the prefixed form is what's uncommon, right? Archaic or just obscure, right? Leaving exactly one, which is actually an irregular verb itself in its ordinary sort of minimal form, right? So out of the 877 least common words in English according to the Brown corpus, one, exactly one, is irregular. And if we sort of stand this on its head and think about it over time, that ends up being, or that amounts to saying, that rarity is a vulnerability for irregular verbs. that a rare irregular verb doesn't survive. We've spoken about this already, just to remind you, right, that one of the first things that people were able to experimentally validate, once the idea of doing experiments in psychology arose at all, was that memory depends on frequency. The more often you hear, see, or experience in whatever way is appropriate something, the better you remember it. No two ways about it. Uncommon words have weak memory entries and are harder to retrieve. Irregular verbs, since they're very common, we get a prediction that they will be easy to retrieve. And it stands to reason then, again, we turn it around, that if an irregular verb starts to lose popularity, because after all, frequency is a contemporary phenomenon. Right? We don't care about how frequent a word was 100 years ago in terms of predicting how well it's going to be learned, how well it's going to be remembered. It's how common it is today. Right? The day the kid starts learning language, that's what matters. Right? And we observe that irregular verbs may lose their status as a result of falling out of favor. Old English had three times as many strong verbs, which are candidates for being irregulars in modern English. Abide had a past tense of abode. Chide, which is itself a pretty minimal word these days. Chid, cleave, clove, which just about still survives, at least in a few sort of historical novels. Geld, gelt. And if you actually look at the 33 ones that survive, the ones that are still irregular occur on average 500 times in the Brown Corpus. Whereas the ones that have become regular occur an average of 21 times. So less than a factor of 10, even more than 10 times fewer. Still, there's no non-awkward way of saying that, is there? So all of these, the prediction, the sort of, at least the correlation between irregularity and frequency is underlined in various different ways. Some of the rarer ones are losing their irregular status more or less as we speak. In fact, I'll predict, based on the fact that you are a few years younger than I am, that some of these don't look right at all to you, whereas to me, they just look a little odd. So smote as the past tense of smite, as opposed to smited. Heave, I think you'll find, even I'm probably likely to say heaved rather than hove. I don't think anybody says hove anymore. Slew, well, maybe that one's still there. I'm not sure. Throve, certainly not. That's gone, right? I mean, that's not a viable past tense for thrive anymore, right? So the number of these irregulars, these rare irregulars, are losing their irregular status. In some cases, at least, I think probably smote or slew are the better examples. They're still in there fighting, and so you might find in the competition that we describe the blocking mechanism as in terms of that they do sometimes succeed in blocking the regular past, but not always. And I don't know if anybody's done a sort of large-scale web corpus-based study of the frequencies of the past tenses of these words in their different forms. In some cases, of course, it's a little difficult because of collisions with other words. Forwent is virtually a joke, right? Nobody says forwent as opposed to foregoed. But neither of them sound terribly good, but we have to have the past tense for forego somehow. And we do have foregone, as in a foregone conclusion. In these marginal, less frequent areas, the whole system just feels slightly creaky and under strain. They sort of lose, they start to get reanalyzed as their own words. So foregone is probably not obviously related to forego in the way that some other derivational pairs are still tightly measured. In fact, you can actually somewhat artificially measure naturalness by asking people, hey, who knows what they're responding, but if you get consistent answers, you can claim to be measuring something. And so Pinker and one of his postgrads investigated people's attitude towards their the different past tenses, simply by asking them to rate the naturalness without further explanation of different verb forms on a scale from 1 to 10. And people were given stems to rate and past tense forms to rate separately to distinguish between past tense forms which were intrinsically unnatural versus the ones that were unnatural because the verb stem itself is unnatural in some way. And the result that they reported is, again, consistent with the story that we've been trying to tell, that Pinker's trying to tell. As I said, we're getting to the end game, and we're going to let Pinker win, right? This lecture is mostly going to be about Pinker's evidence for why he's right, and why McClellan and Rummelhart and the people who peddle a single mechanism approach are wrong, right? We have dual mechanism story that Pinker and Prince are peddling, and the single mechanism stories on the one hand, the pure rule-based story of Chomsky and Halley, SBE, and on the other hand, the pure associative story as told by McClellan and Rummelhart and many others. Sticking with the Pinker story about words and rules, where it's only the past tenses of irregulars that are memorized, right? The rating for the naturalness of an irregular past tense form depended directly on the frequency of those past tense forms. So the more common an irregular past was, the more natural it was. Very straightforward. Right? On the other hand, the naturalness rating of the past tense form of the irregulars was not particularly correlated with the frequency of the stem. Right? So it was the frequency of the irregular form itself that mattered. But for regulars, the rating was independent of the past tense frequency. What they cared about the point is rare past tenses like maimed were just as natural as common forms like walked. That's not enough detail to give you, that's not all the details, see the book, right? But again, it supports the claim that that the irregulars have their own independent status in a way that the regulars don't. Right? They're memorized independently, where the regular past tenses are not memorized independently. A couple of other experiments, running through these relatively quickly. Pinker and some other postgrads investigated how quickly people could produce past tense forms. So I'll tell you the stem and you tell me the past tense. How long does it take? Right? With the irregular forms, the time depended on the frequency of the form. Just what you would expect, given a memory-based theory. It didn't depend on the frequency of the stem, except insofar as those were correlated. Right? So the more frequent irregular past tense forms were produced more quickly than the less frequent ones, even when the verb stems have equivalent frequency. So it's alleged here, I wouldn't know, that ring and strive are roughly equivalent in frequency in English. Right? Nonetheless, rang, which occurs much more frequently than strove, is produced much more quickly. Whereas with regular verbs, there's no correlation between the frequency of the past tense form and the time taken to produce it. So again, supporting the hypothesis of separate memory for the past tense forms. They're stronger in memory, they're easier to retrieve, they're more closely associated or something. And of course, by God, they better be quick. And of course, it's interesting that he doesn't report the number that you would really like to know, which is the number you need to know for the naive understanding of the blocking hypothesis. Right? Do these past tense forms actually get produced faster than regular past tense forms get produced? Even though, of course, you know, it would have to be a regular past for some other verb. Right? But you could match the verbs for stem frequency. And even if you work hard for past tense frequency and say, listen, we can't get the exact competition because we're not going to see ringed at all. Right? But if we could get ring, I say ring, you say rang, I say bake, you say baked, and maybe ring and bake and rang and baked are frequency matched, then it would be really interesting to know what the relative speeds are, wouldn't it? There you go. There's your fourth year project. Finally, in the string of experiments, right, we've done sort of just flat out questionnaire-based ranking. We've got production times. Now we can do perception times, right? In a lexical decision task, we actually talked about this 2 weeks ago. The amount of time that it takes to recognize a word, or at least to recognize that it is a word. And the hypothesis of all of the lexical decision literature is that it tells us something about how memory is organized. And we know, in a parallel way to the whole frequency thing, that repetition priming works. So the time it takes you to recognize that something is a word goes down if you've heard the word before recently. And it falls, you know, that effect falls off with time. Right? And as we discussed a few weeks ago, again, there's a semantic relatedness effect for priming as well. So if I'm going to test you on nurse is the best way to speed you up. But saying doctor is a pretty good way to speed you up. Whereas saying, monitor is not a very good way at all. So there's some kind of linking, some kind of connectivity, some kind of association which gets things primed or ready to be recognized in some fairly unspecified mechanistic way. We still need a model here to get some details so that we would actually get some real predictions out of it. But then, so we got priming, so we can do this obvious question of, well, what about the relative priming effectiveness of words and their past tenses? First observation, regular pasts are more effective at priming their stems than irregulars are. So if I say waved, you'll respond quickly to wave, and that effect, averaged for, you know, controlled for frequency and averaged in all the obvious ways, is greater, the priming is greater, the speed up is better than if I say rang and then ring. So the regular past primes its stem more than the irregular past does. In fact, and this really is a pretty important finding. Wave is just as good at priming wave as wave is itself. And Pinker doesn't have any problem with that. Pinker laps this up. Pinker says, you know, hey, it's part of my hypothesis that wave is involved in dealing with wave, whether production or perception. Right? That it's that word, right? It's right there. It's only some morphological rule that takes that word and combines it with the past tense morpheme and gets it out the door or recognizes it, right? So hearing waved and hearing wave, or producing waved and producing wave, they're intimately related in Pinker's view. The relationship, on the other hand, the relationship between rang and ring is much more like the relationship between doctor and nurse. They're separate but closely related. That's Pinker's story about why these results make him right. And there have been a whole lot of this kind of experiment has been done many, many times in many, many variations, to the point where we can even, in some cases at least, get the delay in the motor cortex out of the way so that we don't have to wait for people to press a button or to say something, which is even longer, but typically to press a button, by actually just using some form of online brain scan, either scalp electrodes or laterally various forms of NMR. And they did control for noise similarity, right? There isn't much, it's not quite the case that there's none, but there's very little phonological priming in general, at least in English, right? So if I'm testing for mark and I prime with mark it, not much happens, right? You don't get much priming or between gravy and grave, right? So the priming appears to actually involve whatever kind of abstraction, and we'll see a little more evidence for this in just a minute, whatever kind of mental entity we think does the merging together, the commonality of the spoken, the written, the grammatical, the semantic, all of the different ways in which a word figures in our language behavior, there's a place where they all come together. It's a little bit like, I can't now remember the order of play. Have you had the attention lectures? Right, so you've talked about maps and the fact that there's shape maps and color maps, and the object is when you bring them together. Right, so there's something similar going on here. Right? It's not exactly, you know, it's the analogy is a little high level, but it's a similar thing. Right? There are phenomena which you can explain purely at the acoustic and phonological level. There are phenomena that you can explain purely at the visual and the letter shape level. But there are phenomena like these which you really have to start explaining at some more abstract or some deeper or some more unified level where things have come together. And in fact, that specific question has been explicitly explored in what's called cross-modal priming. And we didn't talk about this a few weeks ago. Can we say nurse and get doctor to be recognized faster on the screen, or vice versa? And the answer is yes, absolutely. You hear some words, see others, it works just fine, right? And it suggests that thing which we'll call the lexical entry or the abstract word is the thing that matters in terms of these connections that facilitate or inhibit. We haven't talked about inhibition, but there are a parallel set of experiments for ways in which things drive reaction rates down. Sorry, reaction rates up, right? Which slow things down. William Marsland Wilson and Lolly Tyler investigated a bunch of this with regular, they practically invented the paradigm, and they looked at irregular and regulars among many other aspects of language. And indeed, the verbal form asked did prime the relevant verb stem. Ask gave primed give, but not as effectively. Right? So reproducing the unimodal results. And it even works for, you know, there's a whole controversy here about what whether subliminal perception exists or not. It turns out that the original allegations that by projecting one frame in 30 of a desert, you could make people buy more Coke at the beginning of films, that turns out to be false. The guy who claimed he was doing it wasn't actually doing it. But the idea of subliminal perception has ramified and spawned a whole bunch of experimental paradigms. And there's a bunch of argument about whether you're perceiving it or not and what it means to say it's subliminal or unconscious. But at any rate, in the accepted version of the experimental paradigm, where you tune exposure time to the point where people behave at chance in reporting what you showed them. Right? So you flash a verb up on the screen and you, with a particular set of stimuli, and you try to match your populations, you do the experiments reducing the stimulus duration to the point at which people can't reliably report what you're showing, which suggests that at least something has happened, or something hasn't happened, let's put it that way. Nonetheless, that subliminal prime, that I can't report what you showed me prime, does have a facilitation effect on a subsequent probe. Right? So maybe you flash the past tense on the screen, and then at too fast for them to see it, and then they hear the stem in their earphones, and they have to do the lexical decision task, and it works. It speeds them up. But only when it's related. If it's not related, it doesn't speed them up. And they also felt that they could sort of get three distinct levels reliably, right? So you would have regular past priming stem really well, irregular past priming stem pretty well, and semantically related word priming semantically related word, but not quite as well as that, right? So three levels that they could detect. They also found that semantic priming gets washed out very quickly by other intervening stuff, right? Whereas grammatical priming, right? That persists, declines more slowly, right, over some period of time. So you've seen this slide seven times, right? Doesn't hurt to see it again. But the whole story is that we have two mechanisms, and partly because of the kind of phenomena we've just been measuring, we can talk about how the blocking principle actually is implemented as a race. Right? As getting out the door first, as saying, I've got the answer, you know, slow coach, morphological rules, beat you into a cocked hat, forget it. I have the answer. We don't need you. Right? But crucially, as I suggested a little while ago, this does talk about, you know, this is, from the perspective of Occam's razor, a less plausible theory, because it needs two different mechanisms. It needs a memory mechanism, and it needs a rule mechanism. Right? It needs both to predict all the things that it's predicting. And the independence of those mechanisms is crucial to the blocking account as I just sort of animated it. Right? That there have to be two things going on, one of which happens faster than the other, for that story to be the right answer. Whereas, on the one hand, Chomsky and Holly, sorry, I didn't finish the slide, but we knew this, right? Sorry, I'm misremembering the order of the slides. What's the words and rules story good at? Well, it's good at the data we were just looking at. It's good at the whole question of productivity, right? At the fact that this rule applies to things you've never seen before, so how could your association network have trained on it, right? But what it doesn't do is tell you much, if anything, about things like stem-stem regularity, about any areas where phonological similarity also seems to have a role to play. Because it doesn't have any story about similarity at all. None of what we were just talking about appealed to similarity in any way. Right? And there are more experimental facts that underline that area of weakness, right? So we just gave a bunch of experiments that support Pinker. Well, here are some experiments which make him not look so good. That if you ask people to do the WUG test, except the verb version of the WUG test, so binged and ricked and glinged and glend and glended and spritted and queeped and browed, right, or broed, they don't like it as much as when you ask them to give them past tenses for things like ricked and aped. I don't know. I'm not very good at making up non-words. Not surprising, right? There's some interference here that's real, that can be measured, right? And we know, in looking at the history of English over the last 300 years, that some common regulars have become irregular for precisely this reason. So ringed used to be the past tense of ring, but it got sort of sucked in to the pattern that we get from sing. Dig, again, used to be digged, but is now dug. Quit used to be quitted, but is now just quit. So there's something about similarity that Pinker just has not had anything to say about. The words and rules story, as we've described it so far, is just short of having anything to say about. At the other extreme, at one extreme, we have the pure rule model, SPE, which we've talked about as a theory of linguistic structure, but not as a theory about language processing to be taken seriously. It's a theory of what we know, not a theory about how we know it. The other extreme, but that would be a single mechanism model if you could turn it into a psycholinguistic model. If you took something like SPE and said, well, we'll try to make it a more plausible model of how people speak and understand. There's some things you can do to try to do that, and indeed some people have done them, to make the most obvious reasons why it wouldn't work get fixed. That would be a one mechanism model, and from a sort of simplicity viewpoint would then, you might say, have something to recommend it. In the other direction, the connectionist approaches are also single mechanism models. Right. All forms of past tense computation production are handled the same way by the association mechanism captured in a neural network. And all we've got to drive that is similarity and dissimilarity, right? Or analogy, if you want to put it that way. Right. And so they're sort of complementary. They do really well at the stuff that the words and rules model, as we've described it, doesn't have any account for at all. Right? So stem-stem similarity is something which falls out naturally from the associationist mechanism. Right? And furthermore, Something else which we haven't seen Pinker really, well, he's tried to say something about how the race is to the swift in the competition between the blocking mechanism and the morphologically based, rule-based mechanism. And we know that memory speed depends on frequency. So the reason that kids, once they learn the rule, and he hasn't really told us how that happens, but once they do learn the rule, right, the overgeneralization is happening because they haven't seen very many irregular pasts. So the memory is running sort of slowly and the rule track gets out ahead. But as they see more and more irregular instances of the irregular pasts, that starts winning more and more often until by the time they're five or six, it's winning all the time or nearly all the time. Right? With the right kind of training regime, the connectionist models give a very different kind of account of how that victory, you know, of why the deficit is replaced by good behavior. But we think, at least, and I think this is not something which the literature shows much change on, this is an old debate, right? It's necessary in order to teach something like this, that we have something which has a certain amount of history, and there are not a lot of people actively building connectionist models of English past tense inflection today, or much of any other kind of model either, right? This was an interesting episode. It's not over, but the huge energy that was there in the 90s and the early part of this century has decreased again. If you've sort of plotted the number of papers published about English past tense inflection, it ramps up very rapidly after Rummelhart and McClellan published their paper and gets very, you know, and sort of plateaus during the 90s and is declining now. Right? We've talked about the ways in which the connectionist model isn't great, right? In particular, its weakness is that it doesn't do anywhere near as good a job as it should, as the human beings do, on the regulars, right? We just don't make mistakes at anywhere near the rate that it does. And the reason for that is because sound similarity really doesn't matter for the regular ones, right? We just do it. It doesn't matter. There's no obvious implication, right? And there are all kinds of places where evidence for that pops up. Right? That the past tense of pit is pitted. It just is. There's no problem with that. The fact that it sounds like hit and split, which are irregular, doesn't matter. Right? It's not attracted. You would think of, it's just not a problem. Not that we talk about having pitted six bushels of plums yesterday terribly often. And glowed, right? If somebody said glue to you, you would have no idea what they were talking about, except possibly something to stick something together with, right? Glue is just not a plausible past tense for glow, despite the very clear phonetic overlap between glow and grow, right? Where we've got the same initial consonant, a liquid in second place, the same vowel, right? But we get a completely different past tense. Not a problem for us, a real problem for an associationist network. And the most extreme cases, if sound were all that mattered, the word fit, meaning to put together, is an irregular past. It's, you know, I fit three things together. I fit it together and it worked perfectly, right? In the past, but fit to have an epileptic fit, the past tense is fitted, right? And that's a pretty marginal case because it's arguably denominal and all the denominal verbs are regular, but that itself is a set of evidence, right? Which Pinker talks about in the book. We probably won't have time to. Meat is so irregular is so infrequent that it's not this one. That it's not very interesting, and this is an area where people do get confused. Well, I guess not, in the sense that, nobody would say, Alex Salmond has repeatedly lied to the Scottish people about the nature of, I'm sorry, no politics, right? There's no question but the past tense of the verb lie, meaning to tell an untruth, right, is lied. You would never say, Salmond lay to me yesterday, right? No, it's not right. It's not even close to being right. It's not even plausible error, right? Exactly what the past tense of lie, meaning to lie down, is, and when you have the, you know, when it's laid and when it's lay, that's a separate set of problems to do with the fact that certain aspects of intransitive verbs and their past and passive participles are in flux in English, right? But there's no confusion whatsoever between lie, paper's lying on the table, paper has lied on the table, somebody laid the paper on the table 6 weeks ago, and lie lied, right? Denominal verbs, even if they're phonologically absurd, we cha-cha'd and rumba'd all night, right? We're never going to get those out of a connectionist model because it will have nothing like them in its association memory. Right? And it is moderately interesting, although perhaps a little unfair, if you feed one of these things which is not similar phonologically to any of the training data, you get some amazing outputs, right? So you take a well-trained Rummelhart and McClelland, or I'm going to forget the other two guys' names, and you give it non-words, and it comes up with something from right out in left field, right? So if I say to you, what's the past tense of brilth? It doesn't say brilthed or anything like it. It says prevailed. Right? Plog, pleated. Trilb, treelit. Smeege, leaflog. You know, go figure. Well, I mean, I think this is Rummelhart McClelland, because if you look at it, you're seeing some vaguely connected Wickle features here. But the point is that for things you've never seen before, the associationist network doesn't appear to have any useful way to come up with a good output. There's no notion of saying, oh, just copy it. Although, of course, you could start to try to build something like that. You could say, well, okay, you've just given me a set of instructions for what to do, right? Surely we're going to find that the weights with which these things are offered are going to be low, because they're going to be lots of, you know, this is just the best of a bad job, right? Making the best of a bad lot of outputs, picking the highest, the most stimulated one, the best fit for the output units. But it's not going to be very good if we're using any kind of a thresholding activation function which gives you real values, real, you know, values between 0 and 1, then these guys are not going to be very good. So we could make a multimodal, we could come up with a two-module, two-mechanism account which still uses association networks but says, gee, you know, if these scores are really low, we'll prefer this other module, which does have a bunch of copies in it, right? Which just learns to copy at the phoneme level and add one of three suffixes depending on the final phoneme. You could train such a network, right? And you could then put the two networks in place and have a decision function that learned which one to use based on the relative speed and happiness of the outputs. You know, doing this on the fly, as it were, on the back of an envelope, right? But at the very least, it would be still a two-mechanism system. It would be using neural networks to, as it were, program something like the words and rules mechanism. But the obvious conclusion to all of this, you knew Pinker was going to end up here eventually, as he's not stupid, right? Is to take the best of both. And to say, listen, we've got a way of memorizing irregular pasts. Right? But the way we memorize them is not as arbitrary, complete, unanalyzed units, but is using some kind of an associative memory. And so we can then make some kind of a prediction about how new and new words will occur and how similarity effects within the memorized words may appear. Right? So, you know, he waves his hands, he doesn't give, he doesn't go as far as actually producing an associative network that will do the job that he needs done at this point. But it's as the sort of final chapter in this story, which stretches over the 20 or 25 years since the original Rummelhart-McClellan paper, it represents a sort of embrace and extend move in the debate from you're wrong, no, you're wrong, no, here's why you're still wrong, no, here's why you're still wrong, to I'll fix it, to no, you can't fix it, to no, but you can't fix yours either, to all right, yes, you're right, you've got something, there's a point to what you're saying, so I'm going to incorporate some of what you've suggested into my story, right? And that's a classic move that that is entirely reasonable, both scientifically and sort of in terms of the structure of the argument, if you will. Say, yes, you're right. Your mechanism does better at some of the things which my mechanism is bad at, so I'll take the best of yours and add it to mine. And the details still need to be worked out, for better or for worse, right? So, finishing up, semi-productive irregular verbs are handled by the associative bit, and the fully productive default regular inflections are handled by the rules. Those two mechanisms together give an explanation for, on the one hand, we've got two mechanisms. So regulars and irregulars are still qualitatively different on this account. But I'm going to have to ask you to wait just a minute to look at whatever it is that you're enjoying until I finish lecturing, if you don't mind. Thanks. So the naturalness of the irregulars is independent of the verb stems because they've got separate entries, but the association story is still there, okay, to explain the gradation in how comfortable people are with the regulars, with the irregulars, right? And the time taken to produce does now have a frequency component in it, unlike with the regular verbs. So we've tried to end up with the best of both worlds. And it's not a bad story. It needs to be fleshed out in detail. That is, Pinker has not actually ever published a neural network that would do what he wants. But at the level at which the discussion has gone on, it feels like we've made some progress over these 25 years at getting a better idea about how different mechanisms combine to give us a good story about what we observe as this very complicated but demanding of our explanation difference between regulars and irregulars as we see it, at least in English. I'd hope to get to other languages today. I might squeeze a bit of that in tomorrow, because several people, of course, several of you who speak non-native, who speak English, speak non-English languages natively, have asked questions about how this story plays out in your language. And Pinker does have some things to say about that, and I have some notes about that. And if I think I have time, I'll talk about that tomorrow. Thank you. See you tomorrow.
had the question about the lecture slides for lecture 16 and 18. Are they going to appear online or?
I thought I'd done one of them. Let me see.
What's online is 17 and now 19, but 16 and 18.
Oh, sorry, the ones that Helen gave. Yes, I don't. I'm waiting for Helen to give them to me. We're having a meeting tomorrow. I'll remind her that I'm waiting for them.
And about the missed lectures, 14 and 15, were they the next ones you had, or were they jumped? Or?
They're going to be folded into, insofar as we're going to cover that material, it'll be either next week or the week after. I've forgotten. Right? I mean, you don't have to keep looking. They won't appear back in that slot.
Okay, that's what I expected.
Insofar as... as we fit them, we recover them, they'll be in subsequent lectures.
Yeah, so this is, I mean, it's really, really interesting, isn't it? Nobody has really ever done that thing where they test whether regulars or irregular frequency are faster.
I don't know. It wouldn't surprise me if there have been such experiments. I don't work in this area myself, so it's entirely possible that they have. Who would know about this? Ellen Bard might know. I don't know if you have. Which are you in PPLS or are you in?
Yeah.
Right. So Ellen Bard might know. If she doesn't know, she probably knows who does know. So you could ask her.
Pinker did all this experiment. He needed the data. He just needed to take the ratio, and he would have the data.
Well, no, because probably he didn't have. There would have been no reason to match the irregulars and the regulars for frequency. And getting both to get the strongest result, you need to match both the stems and the paths for frequency. And that's going to take a lot of work.
But he had a lot of data with, say, words with the frequency and the tenth, which is just certain with those.
Yeah, it might be he had the data there. Yes.
Yeah, he had the data, he just needed to say third minute.
What you do worry about is the fact that he didn't do that.